From Washington, the American Broadcasting Company brings you From the Capitol, a weekly interview program based on a major news story here in the nation's capital. Our guest is an American hero of the war in Vietnam, the first enlisted man to be nominated for the Legion of Merit, and the soldier selected last July to brief Defense Secretary McNamara on the operations of our special forces, former Master Sergeant Donald Duncan, who now charges in the February issue of Ramparts magazine that our men are dying for a lie in Vietnam. Here to interview Mr. Duncan are ABC News correspondents Keith McBee and, with the first question, ABC's George Watson.
Sergeant, I'm interested in your own personal experiences. You were drafted into the Army when you were 25. You served with a distinguished record, and just recently, apparently, you reached these conclusions. What did you see in Vietnam? What happened that led you to these conclusions?
Well, first of all, let me correct you in that the conclusions aren't something that I came to in the last month or so. I did reach these conclusions while I was in Vietnam. And I suppose the second day I was there, talking with my contemporaries within Special Forces, listening to them condemn the people who we were helping, or supposed to be helping, the Saigon government, how rotten they were, how corrupt they were, the black marketeering, the cynicism that was attached with any workings with the Vietnamese or Arvin troops. I fell into this trap, I think, as I mentioned in the article, that Robin Moore fell into. He found a rationale for it, and at that time I found a rationale for it, in that, well, they may be absolutely the most horrible people in the world, but they are anti-communist. And so I went along with this thing for quite some time. My contact for the first few months in Vietnam was primarily with military people. Later, after I got into this Project Delta thing, it forced me to come in more direct contact with Vietnamese people other than those that are met in bars and in conference rooms and so on. The hypocrisy of our position over there as to why we were in Vietnam, and the sterility of a campaign based solely on anti-communism. In other words, we're not communism. If I can digress for a moment, communism, I'm sure as you well know, is an ideology, and it is a way of life, not one that we're in favor of, but it is something that people can go to, whereas anti-communism is just that. It's just anti-communism. It's not a way of life, and it's not an ideology. Democracy is, but that is not what we're bringing there.
Well, acknowledging the absence of democracy in the entire history of South Vietnam isn't possible. It can be brought when peace comes, when the villages are pacified, when there are free elections, when the Viet Cong are defeated.
Their knowledge of what democracy is, and so of course we always talk about democracy, so they associate democracy with the American troops or the American supported troops. The Viet Cong do not push ideology per se when they go into these villages. Now, the people in the villages, the communists are in there one day, the Saigon troops are in there the next day, and they see firsthand the benefits of one against the other. It's not ideology, but it's the practical benefits they see.
Sergeant Duncan, you say, and I quote, "Our men are dying for a lie in Vietnam and corrupting the very word democracy." What do you mean by that?
Our administration has been continually pointing out, not only to the public, but to the soldiers going over to Vietnam, that we're going there to preserve freedom or to introduce freedom in democratic institutions. Just the opposite is true, of course. There are fewer democratic institutions within South Vietnam now than there was, let's say, in 1954. When you ask people to fight for freedom and fight for democracy, then hopefully you are doing exactly that, which, of course, we're not.
What do you think the United States is there for, sir?
This gets into the question of why the United States is there, which goes back, first of all, with our involvement with the French, and then our involvement with the Diem regime, the Michigan State University project, etc. I think, or is the impression of most people, that we've more or less got a tiger by the tail, and we don't know how to let go of the thing.
We've just gotten deeper and deeper.
We have gotten deeper and deeper. I can't say
that
it was accidental, per se. Mm-hmm. I think we were trying to impose the system upon the Vietnamese, believing that given a choice, that they would gladly take our system.
Well, from a standpoint, Sergeant, of world opinion and of morals, do we have any recourse but to stay and fight in Vietnam?
I think our being there is the biggest immorality there could be, in that we are trying to tell a people that you are going to have our system whether you want it or not, and to force this upon them, we are bombing and killing the people.
Sergeant, what specifically do you think we ought to do in Vietnam right now?
You're talking about tactically, strategically, or politically?
Well, all three, or any of them.
Well, one, our tactics and strategy aren't working because they're based on the assumption that that we are helping the people. And in actual fact, it's the people we're fighting. And politically, I would say that the only decent thing we could do to salvage, if any prestige, if any that we may have left, we should withdraw. And I think when we talk about negotiations, it should be done from the point of view of how can we extract ourselves from there. I think the talk about negotiations up to this point have always been with the idea, well, what will we have left in Vietnam after the negotiations, which in other words means the NLF, or as we always like to refer to it,
National Liberation Front.
Right, Hanoi, what have you, will actually have to give something away in a negotiation. And, of course, they're reluctant to do this because they have it now anyway.
Well, it's been said, sir, that if there were an election tomorrow, it's probable or possible that the Viet Cong might actually get elected. Wouldn't this be because the people there are so sick of war after 20 years of it that they'd vote for anyone who would guarantee them peace however they are ruled?
If it was just a matter of guarantees, I'm sure we would guarantee them peace also. It came down to an election campaign. It has been estimated, I think the first person that made an estimate on it was President Eisenhower. He estimated in 1954 that 80% of the people would vote for Ho Chi Minh or the National Liberation Front, although it wasn't known by that name at that time. Since that time, General Ki, the premier of Vietnam, has stated, and I believe this was in an interview with Mr. Reston, that the National Liberation Front is closer to the aspirations of the Vietnamese people than the Saigon government. This has come about through land reform. The Viet Cong have lived in the villages. The people can relate to the Viet Cong
relate in a kind of heinous way. If the village chieftain doesn't go along with them, they cut his head off. Isn't that true?
This thing about village chieftains always seems to overlook the point that most of these village chiefs that are or have been assassinated were appointees from the Saigon government and not people elected. In 1956, the very year in which we were supposed to have elections in Vietnam, Diem instituted two laws eliminating elective offices in the villages. And the chiefs and so on that were there, he took them out and he replaced them with these appointees. To say that killing village chiefs and so on would terrify or horrify the people beggars the issue that, first of all, the NLF are very good at guerrilla warfare. I don't think anybody will deny this. The communists are very good at guerrilla warfare. When you kill people, you always have to estimate what feeling this will or how it will react to the people or react upon the people. Where in actual fact, by killing these chiefs, they are getting support of the people because these chiefs have been unpopular.
Sergeant, let me ask you this. You were a Green Beret, you were Special Forces, and you have in your articles said some very unkind things about that outfit. Isn't it true that in war, especially, soldiers are tough, trained that way, and to think that way? You have cited examples, you say, of racial prejudice, of terms of opprobrium for the Vietnamese, for our own American Negroes in those forces. Isn't this part and partial of being a soldier, in fact, an elite soldier, a tough guy, in effect?
You have to consider, first of all, that special forces are designed to work primarily with ethnic groups. And it's absolutely imperative when you're working with ethnic groups that you can't let any personal prejudices show or even be known. If an individual has some, they should be deeply subverted. However, right within special forces themselves, there are many individuals who make no bones about their prejudice against our own Negro people. It only stands to reason people with these deep-seated prejudices have a tremendous amount of trouble relating to ethnic groups in other countries, and their effectiveness is diminished accordingly.
I take it, sir, you have nothing much against the draft card burners and the demonstrators on these shores. Is that right?
I don't always approve of their methods, but the sentiments that lead to these actions, I'm in sympathy with.
Would you encourage young men who are about to be drafted or in college to get out and demonstrate, carry signs, say we ought to get out of Vietnam, negotiate, whatever?
You're asking me to incite people to riot?
No, I'm not. I'm just asking you about peaceful demonstrations and protest.
I see absolutely nothing wrong with peaceful protest, assuming the people are sincere in what they are protesting. I have met a lot of these protesters, and I found most of them to be very sincere. Granted, there are those that are doing it because they like to be part of a group and be associated with exciting things and so on. But by and large, most of the people I have met in the peace movement have been young adults. These aren't 17, 18-year-old kids. These are 22, 23, 25, anywhere up to 30-year-old people. And it's not a lark with them. They're very serious about it. It's something they've studied. In fact, you'll find most of these people are much more erudite on the subject of Vietnam than the so-called hawks in this country.
Tell us a bit, sir, about the South Vietnamese soldier. Is he a good one?
South Vietnamese soldier, as an individual, of course he's a good one. We're fighting them every day over there. We call them Viet Cong.
I'm referring to the government troops.
Any soldier in any army is as good as his training, his leadership, and the cause for which he's fighting.
Isn't it true that 80% of the Vietnamese government troops are enlisted rather than drafted?
No, I don't know what the exact figures are on that, but I would take exception to that figure. I know the trouble that the South Vietnamese forces have had getting men into their armed forces, the draft sweeps that they have through the towns. For instance, Nha Trang, where they pick up people with and ask for identification. They have no identification, or they found they're not registered with the draft and so on. They're just picked up and thrown willy-nilly into service.
Well, you fought alongside the Vietnamese, sir, as well as against them.
The Vietnamese that I worked with on this project, I couldn't have asked for a better group of people. They were very crafty. They were they could handle themselves well in the jungle. Their bravery was beyond repute, and they were just damn nice people. I enjoyed them. They were. Saved my life many times.
But do you contend they don't think they're fighting for anything?
These people, when I got to know them well enough that we could discuss these things, we weren't, it sort of boiled down, we weren't fighting for democracy or freedom or these things. We were more or less fighting because we liked each other. In other words, the particular thing we did, which was unique in Vietnam at that time, this going into deep in a Viet Cong-controlled territory, staying there for 4, 5, 6 days, and which puts you in a position, your chances of getting out are very slim. They kept doing this time after time after time, but they weren't doing it because of any great loyalty for the Saigon government. We had formed a certain mystique amongst ourselves. We had trained ourselves until we thought we were elite, and it was more or less everything for the Corps, more or less the spirit of the Foreign Legion, more than any great... patriotism.
Sergeant, I wanted to clarify one thing in my mind. The president's just back from Hawaii, and there was a declaration of Honolulu and a joint communique speaking of vast social and economic reforms that we, in conjunction with Vietnamese, are supposed to undertake. Don't you think that this, combined with our military efforts there, are a better solution than simply pulling out and leaving the Vietnamese to Ho Chi Minh's brand of communism?
I would say if these programs had been instituted in 1954, they would have been absolutely amazing. And had they, first of all, been directed at all Vietnamese people. If you're, President Johnson didn't specify whether these programs were aimed at all the Vietnamese or those in sympathy with the Saigon government. It's pretty well accepted, I think, by most people that have ever been there and know anything about it, that 70 to 80% of the people are in sympathy with the Viet Cong or the NLF. So who is the program aimed at? The 30%, the 70%, or the 100%? And how do you get to the 70%? How do you hold them down long enough to get the castor oil down his throat?
Well, is it possible to do that in your estimation, or are we just too late?
I like to use the analogy of you bomb a person and in the name of freedom and then come in and bandage his burns from the bombing. It sort of puts the medic in a peculiar position. I I can't see. If we were really interested in the welfare of the Vietnamese people, we would try and get these benefits to all the Vietnamese people, and then take our chances in the political arena with everybody else.
You say, sir, in your article, and I'll quote you, resentment of Americans by South Vietnamese runs all the way from stiff politeness to obvious hatred. It is so common that if a Vietnamese working with or for Americans is found to be sincerely cooperative, energetic, conscientious, and honest, it automatically makes him suspect as a Viet Cong agent. Is the American really that hated by every Vietnamese?
Well, of course, not by every Vietnamese. Those that are making money from the Americans, if not exactly in love with us, they certainly don't hate us because they're making millions of dollars from the American soldiers.
Do they think of us precisely as they thought of the French?
They resent us. They really do. You see, we're trying to do something the French never attempted to do. We're not only asking the people to take our system, we're also asking them to love us. This is something the French never attempted to do. We get into some pretty fine philosophical points on that. However, it was a matter of cynical humor at the time, this statement that you quoted from, that you would meet one of these individuals who was honest, which was rare for a Vietnamese working around Americans, and he would be the hustler, the guy that really got the job done. It turned up so many times that these guys were agents for the NLF, it became a standard joke. You find somebody that's honest and appears to like Americans, he's suspect as an agent.
Mr. Duncan, we read quite a bit about corruption in Saigon and high living and that sort of thing. From your own experience, did you witness any of that?
Oh, there's a tremendous amount of corruption over there. If I could back up for one moment, General Key, the present premier, I had very high hopes for him when he took office. The man's bravery was unquestionable. As you know, he went on the first flight into North Vietnam, picked up bullet holes in his own plane, had a reputation as being a true patriot. In other words, regardless what side he was on, he really had the interest of his country at heart. He was going to do these great things about speculators, black marketeers, people that were working on money exchange and so on. In fact, he made the statement that he personally would shoot them with it, you know, and he brandished his pistol around, which is very dramatic, but you're dealing with a different type of people there, and it was very impressive. So I really did have high hopes for this man. However, at the time that I left there, which was September, excuse me, General Key had been in power then for some time. Just the opposite was occurring. The speculation was getting worse. People were hoarding rice and selling it at inflated prices. A piece of ice that was 10 cents was now a dollar. A bottle of beer that was 15 cents was a dollar and a quarter. And on and on. Of course, these are small items, but this you can project this against the whole economy. When you couldn't get American soap in the PX, you could always go downtown and buy it at six times the price off the Vietnamese economy. So I'm not just holding the Vietnamese to blame for this, of course. They need Americans to get hold of this equipment, too.
Sergeant, let's talk about a pretty chilling subject. I think the cruelty of the Viet Cong is unquestioned. You say, sir, that Special Forces trainees are told about prisoners, you don't have to kill them yourself, let your indigenous counterpart do that. Meaning, I assume, the South Vietnamese soldier. Can you tell us an example of that?
The context of that thing is, within training now, we project the Special Forces team in another country, ostensibly a country where the government is unfriendly to the base of the people, and we're in there helping the people rather than the government. Something, by the way, that hasn't happened yet. And you're told that, first of all, that guerrillas don't take prisoners. Very bad policy. You tie up too many people taking prisoners. If you get prisoners and you don't know what to do with them, you don't have to shoot them yourself. In fact, it's possibly even bad policy for you to shoot them yourself. But
bad
the thing
form.
In bad form, right, is just not done, you know. So you turn them over to your indigenous counterparts, is the terminology used, and you let him dispose of any prisoners.
Sergeant, as a Green Beret, a Special Forces sergeant, were you trained how to torture prisoners to extract information from them?
This was done in a left-handed way. In fact, I even taught this subject. It wasn't just taught to me. It's covered under a subject called Countermeasures to Hostile Interrogation. One of the references for this particular subject is the a page or a couple of pages out of the NKVD manual, which is the secret police of Russia, or was, where in great detail the Russians have listed, you know, different tortures, hanging a man and spinning him around, beating him over the head with him, buckets on his head, etc. Some more that get into the, a little nastier and ghastly than that. It became obvious to anybody sitting in these classes after a while that, quite obvious, unless a man was just some sort of a fanatic, there was no countermeasure to this type of interrogation. In other words, if the feeling was put out, if they wanted you to talk and they wanted to spend enough time and enough patience doing one way or the other, either psychologically or physically, they could make you talk.
Well, in Vietnam, so, did you see these methods used on Viet Cong prisoners by American troops?
Not by American troops, no. You keep in mind, American troops weren't fully committed to the larger battles as of September. Now, Americans were with Vietnamese troops in the field, of course, for, you know, many months and years before this. And these things were, some of these things were common practice with the Vietnamese against the Vietnamese. Little or no protest was made by the Americans. Some people, as individuals, protested this, not on the basis of humanity so much, but just as it is a lousy way to get information. In other words, you're going to make somebody talk if you apply enough pressure. To get back to the way it's taught at Fort Bragg, when I questioned this when it was first taught, well, you know, why are you, what's this about countermeasures to hostile interrogation when obviously there is no such a thing? Is this being directed to us so we in turn know now how to torture other people? And there was this cynical laugh about this, and I said, well, we can't say it that way because the mothers of America wouldn't approve.
Does it appear to you now that the United States is winning militarily in Vietnam?
I haven't been there since September, since the large battles with the conventional troops, or so-called conventional troops, have been used. I don't, ostensibly, we're not using a policy of holding land. I see the same thing happening with the American troops that happened with the Vietnamese troops, and if this is any indication, I'd say, no, we're not winning militarily.
They seem to be showing up, these Viet Cong and regular battalions.
Well, if we are to believe our own casualty reports on this. However, I'd like to point out, for instance, this battle that's going on right now in the An Lao Valley. I happen to be in that valley with six other people last year, and it is... the Viet Cong are just in there. They're in villages. They tax each other. They actually have a civic administration, a much more effective one than so on.
The valley is untakeable.
Well, no, it's not untakeable. You can take the land, but you can't take the people because they just move out ahead of you, and as soon as you move out, they come back. So actually, you have won nothing.
Sergeant, I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. I want to thank you for being our guest today on From the Capitol.
Our guest this week has been former Master Sergeant Donald Duncan, American hero in the Vietnam War. He was interviewed by ABC News correspondents Keith McBee and George Watson. Next week at this same time, the American Broadcasting Company will bring you another program, From the Capitol. We hope you'll be with us. From the Capitol is produced by Peggy Whedon. A presentation of ABC Radio News.